Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP. Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 112 of Registry Matters. Saturday night, Larry, we are like on time recording. This is something kind of new.
Well, it's not that new. We've been doing it for 100 plus episodes.
Yeah, but for the last... like almost since Thanksgiving, it's been kind of like a crapshoot of whether it would be Saturday, Friday, Sunday in the afternoon, evening, Monday. So, you know, it's been all over the place with traveling and all the other complications of everything.
Well, that is true. We've had some variation. Didn't we do it on time last week, or were we off schedule last week?
I think we were on time, but that was like the first time and no one knew, and we were still sort of rusty from being on time. But so since we were all out of whack and traveling and whatnot, I need you to tell me a story like the Larry philosophy of travel of why you need to get a rental car with a license plate from the state that you're going to be in predominantly, I guess is the way to word that.
Well, it's long since been known that people who are from out of state, let me qualify that. People who are from other states, unless you live in that conglomeration of states that are very tiny, where it's more common to be out of state. If you live in Texas, you have to travel a great distance to get out of Texas unless you happen to live on the border, but you have to travel a great distance. So these large geographical states, they love to raise revenue from people who are from other states because they don't have a political voice per se. They don't have connections. They don't have anybody to call. And so therefore, my life experience has led me to understand that you have a greater chance of encountering law enforcement when you have an out-of-state license plate. So therefore, when I rent a car, I try to get, if possible, get a car that has a plate in the state where I'm renting.
I see. So you expect that if you're in, you know, Delaware, like, I mean, if you sneeze, you're going to end up outside of Delaware. So it wouldn't be that big of a deal to have a Maryland or Jersey tag if you were in Delaware.
That is correct.
Gotcha. But if you're in pretty much all of the southern states and then all the way through like west of Kansas, those are big enough states that you wouldn't have generally you wouldn't have people crossing through the state unless they were from out of town.
That is correct. If you're in Georgia and in the county of Houston and a New Mexico plate with the land of enchantment rolls through, that officer is going to say, wow, don't reckon I've seen one of them before.
Now, when you said Houston, do you actually mean Houston?
Well, if you were in Texas, but not in Georgia.
That sounds so strange to me.
But that officer is going to, now if they're on a quota system, which law enforcement always denies there's any such thing, but towns are under great pressure to raise revenue to pay for public safety. And one of the ways they raise revenue is through their municipal court functions, which are traffic citations and municipal ordinances, the fines associated with Operation Municipal Court. So therefore, if I'm driving in a town and I've got an out-of-state plate and I'm going 40 in a 25, there's a lot greater chance that I'm going to draw the attention of the officer and I'm not going to be able to talk my way out of it. Therefore, it's nice to not draw the attention to start with.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I hadn't really considered that avenue, but that makes a lot of sense. Plus, I don't really ever rent a car, but that's just me. All right, let's. Here's how this is going to go tonight. We have breaking news for the first time in quite a while. Tell me what these three like hot button items are going to be for the evening before we go on and cover some news items.
Well, the breaking news, really only two of them would qualify as news, and one of them would only be breaking news. The Butts County Sheriff, which is Sheriff Gary Law, which we at NARSL found a legal team put together and sued regarding Halloween signs. That case is on appeal to the 11th Circuit, and the Butts County legal team filed their appeal, which we're going to try to dive into a little bit later on. So that's news story number one out of Butts County, which the county seat, for those of you who are not familiar with Butts, is Jackson. And
all right.
Jackson is a familiar city. I believe that would be the capital of Mississippi.
That would be, but this is a different Jackson.
Yeah, this is Jackson, Georgia.
Right.
County of about 20,000 people in central Georgia.
Yes.
The next item is going to be the notice that's going to be soon delivered to Cobb County, which is a metro Atlanta suburban northwest county, formerly represented by Congressman Newt Gingrich in the U.S. House of Representatives. They are going to be put on notice about some of their invented requirements, which we'll get into what requirements they're inventing to impose on people who are required to register. And then the third one we're going to get into is the case out of Illinois, Murphy versus Raul. And we've talked about that some months back when the decision came down as for people who have served the totality of their prison sentence are not being released because the supervising authorities who have the responsibility to supervise their period of mandatory, it's called MSR, mandatory supervised release, they don't like where the person would be going, so therefore they continue to hold them in prison. So a federal judge who had already found the statute to be unconstitutional has issued a permanent injunction in the case, so we'll be able to go into that a little bit. So that's going to be our deep dives tonight.
Man, that's a lot of stuff to worry about, Larry. You're loading us up tonight.
That is why I am here.
Oh, I think that is my cue, isn't it? That is totally cue.
We could do that later.
Hang on. I got it. It's right here.
That is why I am here.
That is why I am here. So then I guess we should dive into some news articles before we go into those deep dives. I also then have a news clip that I need, a little sound clip from an article. The first article comes out of the Washington Post that talks about why innocent people take a plea. And I just grabbed a little piece of it. And because you've talked about this a whole bunch of times, but let me play this clip and we can talk about it for a minute.
Does either counsel know of any reason that I should not accept the defendant's guilty plea? You want to shout, yes, Your Honor, this plea is the product of an extortive system of devastating mandatory minimums and lopsided access to evidence. My client faced an impossible choice. He is saying what is necessary to avoid the possibility of losing his life to prison. Instead, you reply, no, Your Honor.
So have you ever been in the courtroom defending somebody, even like as a helper person to counsel, or is that you've just been on the office side of the defense?
No, I've been in the courtroom enough times when guilty pleas are accepted. Yes, I'm quite familiar with how the process goes.
Oh, wait, I figured that part. But you are handed, like, would you rather have your Achilles tendon chopped off, or would you rather have, you're given an impossible choice, and you have a disturbingly minimal amount of information that you are trying to make the best decision possible out of that whole exchange. And that seems to be when you are offered a plea deal from the prosecution that just everything is stacked against you and there's almost like no right answer and you don't have a lot of time to make a decision and you certainly don't have enough information to make a decision.
I guess I would take some disagreement with the issue of the time. You should have all the time you need. I said should, because oftentimes people are in custody and they haven't had regular communication with their attorney. The case may have been pending for 9, 10, 12 months, maybe even more, but they've had such minimal contact with their attorney that it's been difficult for them to go through the options and to have, but time, I would take some disagreement with that. You've got a lot of time. But what happens is, in reality, the attorney shows up, you've been in custody, they haul you over in shackles, and the plea is offered to you right then. The prosecutor makes it sound like it's a really fantastic plea offer, and it really often is, considering the alternatives that could flow to you if you were to go on trial and if you were to be convicted. It often is an attractive plea, but it's based on a stacked deck. And they give you a limited amount of time. Sometimes they want you to decide right then, or sometimes you're given a matter of a few days. It's set for a pretrial conference, and you're there on pretrial, and they say this offer is only going to be on the table for 10 days because they have to make the trial date set 45 days later. They have to make witness preparations to get people there, particularly if they're from out of town. And they do have all the cards. But thanks to our victims' advocates, and the desire to make it impossible for a person to actually have any presumptions anymore of innocence, any presumptions that of due process. You go into this with, if you don't plead guilty, you're not accepting responsibility. So particularly in the federal system, you get hammered for avoidance of responsibility if you don't plead guilty. So if that was a response to a federal plea, if you don't plead guilty, if you go to trial, you get jacked up on sentencing because that was non-acceptance of responsibility. Isn't that a great thing?
Amazing. But I was just going to ask you, well, if you didn't do anything wrong, then you shouldn't have anything to worry about. You shouldn't have to worry about a plea deal. You shouldn't have to worry about taking it to trial, that you're not going to be found guilty even if you do take it to trial because you didn't do anything wrong, right?
Well, wouldn't it be nice if it were that simple? But it's not a question. This is what defendants get very upset about. It's not a question of whether you did or didn't do anything wrong. It's a question of what can they convict you of. And they look at you and they roll their eyes and they practically tip their chairs over backwards when you tell them that. It is not a question of whether or not you did anything wrong. It's a question of whether they can convict you of what they've accused you of. I see you're rolling your eyes also.
Absolutely. I'm thinking about it in the context of one of the stories that we dropped about the person that's getting out after 43 years, and he's probably going to get nothing. And like I said, the story got dropped, but he was going to get out after he got out after 43 years, and he's like, quote unquote, suing. I guess that's the right term. And he would be awarded $50,000 a year for every year for a wrongful conviction. But they passed that law in 2008. He obviously got locked up before that. So he doesn't qualify for it. So he's just going to get a pat on the butt and say, good game. Good luck.
That's correct. But I thought it was because he had a prior conviction also that he wasn't eligible under the criteria of that law. A person who had another felony conviction couldn't be compensated. But when you go to trial, it's not a question of what you did. It's a question of can they secure a conviction. Now, you've heard me talk about strict liability crimes. For example, many sex offenses are strict liability, but it's not the only thing. It's not the only thing. Drug possession, particularly in the state of Florida, is a strict liability offense. So,
and quickly explain what that is. Is that where even if you don't know about the drugs in the car, you're still guilty of them being in your car?
Yes, there's no criminal intent. There's no knowledge. So in the state of Florida, you have possession of drugs. So if the officer pulls you over and all the hovercraft that's focused on the car illuminates, and then the dogs come in to sniff and they find drugs, you are guilty of it because you had possession of them. And it could very well be that you didn't know that you had possession of drugs. I can think of some scenarios where you might not know. For example, if it's a family vehicle, another member of the family may have stashed the drugs in the car. It could be that you bought the car and they were stashed because it was a drug runner's car and you had no reason to suspect there'd be drugs in the car. Yeah, it could be any number of reasons, or it could be that you have something that you think is legal that turns out that isn't, but you weren't intended to commit a crime. But if you go to trial on that and it's a strict liability offense in Florida, and you can assert an affirmative defense where you have the burden of showing that you were not criminally responsible. There's no criminal intent. They've just shifted the burden to the accused. Well, you're going to be convicted even though you didn't do anything wrong, because the people in the jury box, unless they decide to do a nullification, if they like you for some reason and decided they're going to be a renegade jury, they're going to be instructed to find you guilty unless you meet the burden of the affirmative defense, is to show that you had no reason to believe that there were drugs. That and oftentimes the affirmative defense is beyond your reach. You can't meet the burden. An affirmative defense is one of those offenses where you acknowledge that the drugs were in the car, but you put forth a theory of why you should not be held criminally responsible. It'd be like self defense. Yeah, I smashed him over the head. I sure as hell did, but I did it to defend myself. Well, the burden is on you at that point. So you've acknowledged the state's accusation that you took the crowbar and you bashed him over the head. So that's no longer in contention. So you've affirmed the state's allegation. But you're saying, please absolve me of criminal responsibility because I was doing this. If I didn't do this, he was coming on pretty fast with a blade. And I happened to land a lucky blow. Well, the jury has to believe you. And the burden, that's your burden to carry. Wouldn't it be great if you could just say that anything you did was in self-defense? We'd have a whole lot of people who'd get away with a lot of things. So therefore, in an affirmative defense, it's like not guilty by insanity. The burden is on the person to carry that defense to its conclusion when they assert that. And, of course, it never works, seldom ever works. But so you're going to be convicted. So back to the point, it's not a question of what you did. A good lawyer tells you, Andy, I believe you. You've convinced me you didn't do this. But if we put this on trial in Houston County, the jury is going to convict you. Yes. There's a 95% certainty that they will convict you. And here's why. Mm-hmm. Now, if you want to roll those dice, you can, because you have every right to do that. You have every right to do that. But here we have a jury pool that's not very sophisticated, and we've got all these constraints on terms of what we're allowed to do. In terms of putting on a defense, we're not going to be allowed to go after the accuser the way you'd like to see us do it. The judge is going to shut that down. And so at the end of the testimony, when we rest, because we're not going to be able to put you on, they're going to be able to impeach you because of these inconsistencies and the fact that you have a prior record or whatever it is. You're not going to be a credible witness. So you're going to be convicted. And under the arrangements that we've gotten offered, they're going to give you no more than 3 years in prison and 7 more years under supervision. If you go to trial, all options are off except the maximum penalties. And if you get convicted of the two offenses, which I believe you probably will, you're going to be subject to 18 years of incarceration. And based on the sentencing practices here in Houston County, there's a very good chance you're going to get most, if not all, of that. Yes. So that's my duty to tell you that. But at the end of the day, if you want to go on trial, you can. But the point that the commentator is making there is that's exactly why the person pleads guilty. The person says, well, under that scenario, that I'm going to be convicted and I'm going to get 3 or 4 times a harsher sentence, even though in my heart I know I didn't have any criminal intent, I have no choice. Yeah. That's the position.
Can you circle back? What in the world is this hovercraft? What is that kabuki stuff you're talking about?
The hovercraft is the craft that watches the people on the registry. Every person has a hovercraft assigned to them.
Wait, we have individual, there's a million-ish, whatever, 900,000 hovercrafts flying around watching every one of us?
Yes.
Oh, holy crap. I didn't know that. That's amazing.
Yes. Well, that's what I have learned, because the people that are on the registry believe that, and in all seriousness, they are being watched a lot more closely than any other offender category. There's absolutely no challenge or question to that. But they're not being watched.
Jen in chat says it's easy to watch everyone since they're emitting radiation.
but they're not being watched quite as closely as so many of them fear they're being watched. What they are having done to them is very, very naughty. I mean, law enforcement are putting transmitters, GPS trackers on people's cars surreptitiously doing that. And that's not right. They're putting cameras on public right of way and neighbor's yards. That's not right. So they're doing a number of things that are not right, that they shouldn't do. And they are gathering an awful lot of information, and they're monitoring all the social media. They've got detectives that are sitting there. If you have social media, they figure out they watch your social media. So I'm not implying that there's no watching. But I just don't believe they know the minute you cross the state line yet.
Let's move over to an article from non-doc, N-O-N-D-O-C. I don't know what that would be, non-doc. I can't quite come up with that would be offhand. Anyway, Oklahoma pays $1.45 per hour for prison telemarketing. From a prison point of view, that is probably 8 times higher than, you know, if you're in an institution that actually does pay. In Georgia, they don't pay. But that would be pretty kick-ass money for $1.45 an hour. And you know, some of the jobs in prison are kind of on the crappy side. So I'm assuming telemarketing, you would be sitting roughly behind a desk and you would have a headset on and you would just be answering phone calls, or in this case, marketing for someone. That would be sweet work. And I say that with quotes around it just to kind of diminish my intent there. But, you know, in comparison, why is this a bad idea?
Well, at first blush, that was my reaction. The governor of Oklahoma is looking into it. He didn't know anything about these contracts with these marketing companies, but they apparently run the gamut. There's Case Energy Partners, there's GreenWave Concepts, Procom, and they have contracts that range from $1.45 to looks like $3.25 an hour.
It's pretty strong.
Oh, actually, $3.75 an hour. That they're paying. The federal minimum wage is $7.25, where it's been stuck since 2009. But some leadership, lawmakers, not leadership, but some lawmakers on both sides of the aisle have questioned if this is exploitation, because
that is my question to you.
And I don't know, because prisoners are not even covered by most protections of labor, that they are carve out for practically everything where they're in custody. So I guess the question would be, the state of Oklahoma has to determine if they want to make a labor pool available to these private businesses, which in essence would be a form of a subsidy to the businesses, and if they are receiving benefits for that subsidy that outweigh the cost of the subsidy. But the lawmakers are saying, well, gee, this is depriving them of the opportunity to pay fines or restitution, and you know, this is just horrible. And I'm not sure it is horrible. If they didn't have this job, I don't know what Oklahoma prisons pay if they have jobs across the board for everyone. I don't know the nuances of the pay scale, but this is on the high side of the states who do pay. If you're getting $1.45 to $3.75 an hour, this is some pretty good prison pay.
Let me throw this at you. I don't know. I'm just thinking about this offhand. Our government has been criticizing other nations, let's call them China, for like currency manipulation, where the government is almost like propping up businesses in there. I want to say like the solar companies and then even like the steel manufacturers, so that they can bring a product to market that is significantly cheaper than anything that we can bring in, bring out there. So that makes us less competitive. Doesn't this make those companies that are hiring the prisoners, doesn't that make them have a better rate that they can offer to provide their product, because they're getting labor at a quarter, maybe even, you know, a fifth or a sixth of the rate that the public sector would be able to provide?
Well, if I'm understanding the article, they're paying the state the minimum wage. The state is just siphoning, and my accountant loves it when I use that term, siphoning, but the state's just siphoning off the difference. And
so that they can pay for room and board, essentially?
Well, I'm guessing it's being used to offset. The corrections department was hesitant to make anyone available for comment for the story, but I'm guessing that they're rolling this into the general fund. I always never assume that it's going straight. We've got listeners who believe that this is a corruption. It's going straight to some executive who made the contract pocket. I don't assume that without any evidence. I'm assuming that this money is going back to the state general fund. It's being used somehow in the prison budget. But wouldn't the state of Oklahoma be benefiting from that? Because if they're getting at least a federal minimum wage of $7.25, wouldn't they be getting money for these labor hours where these people would not be recouping any money at all? Isn't this an offset to the state's budget?
It seems like it might be then. I was totally looking at it from a respect that the company was only paying the $3.75 an hour. And so then they would be able to bring their product to market saying, you know, we only have to charge these much dollars less because we have these employees that are getting paid grossly below the minimum wage number. But if they're using that, so I don't know. Tell me what your liberal pointy head idea of this is. This bad, or would you vote for this if it were coming up in your legislative scheme?
Well, if you look at the first paragraph of the story and second line, it says the companies pay DOCA $7.25 per hour minimum wage for each of the more than 200 incarcerated individuals. But the prison telemarketing program only pays the workers at $1.45 an hour plus whatever bonuses. So, which tells me that from a public policy perspective, if you've got 200 inmates who are generating $7.25 an hour, isn't that more than what most inmates are generating for the state?
Perhaps, yes. I don't know. The difference there isn't that great, though, Larry. The difference there is, let's call it $5 an hour-ish, or, you know, $6 an hour. So that's $12,000 a year. That's not what it costs you to be incarcerated.
No, but this is the question I'm raising is how many of your inmate population, say Oklahoma has 12,000 inmates incarcerated. Wouldn't it be great if all 12,000 were bringing in $7.25 an hour? The conservatives would normally be eating that up because that would be offsetting the cost of their whatever extent the 725 raises. If you've got 14,000 inmates and the other 13,800 are not raising anything, which is the better class of inmates to have?
Oh, totally. I totally understand that. And those would certainly be like the cream of the crop with the better communication skills and not messing with the authority. I assume that these would be the cream of the crop. These would be like the quote unquote good inmates.
Well, I would assume that I would assume they would not put the troublemakers in. I would also assume that they would put people in who can speak clearly, who have manners,
yes.
who have patience. I probably wouldn't make a yep. very good person for this job, for that paper job. But
they, do tell Larry, why would you not make a good person for this job?
I doubt, but I suspect there's but this seems to be a win-win. And it's always a good thing to ask questions. And actually, sure. it is the Republican leader asking one of and a Democratic leader asking questions. So it is leadership. It says House Majority Floor Leader John Eccles, and then Senator George Young, who's on Democrats from such a minority in Oklahoma that you'd have a hard time finding more than one. But this seems to be a win-win.
Very well.
So how would I vote for it?
Yes.
Well, I would probably look at the totality of is this a policy that improves the chance of an inmate reintegrating successfully? And if I can answer that in the affirmative, and if I could answer in the affirmative, is the revenue from this, because revenue is a part of everything. It shouldn't be in some people's mind, but it is. Any type of expansion of program or opportunity behind the walls is going to have a cost tag. So I would look at this as an expansion of programming that seems to have a positive income stream for the prisons. This is not one where we're having to invest money. This is one where we're getting a check back. So it would seem to pass most of my idealism of getting people better prepared for release, because these are jobs that exist in the national economy. And you remember I've pontificated that people should be provided training and skills that would translate to the free world. These are jobs that exist in the free world. So I would tend to want to be deferential to such a program. That doesn't mean I wouldn't want to hear the concerns, but I would tend to want to give this program a chance.
One other thing before we move on to the next article is, do you think then that this could create some kind of perverse incentive to keep people locked up past whatever their time would be to fill some sort of quota of, hey, look, you know, we're short staffed now because these people got released. Can you hold on to these people? Can you put their paperwork? Can you lose it for a week or whatever so that we can hold on to a certain employee number, you know, XYZ, because they do a great job, or these employees that we need these numbers?
I mean, anything's possible. I would be surprised if that, being that there's only 200 of people in the program and there are thousands of inmates, something tells me that there'll be qualified people. I've been in communication with enough prison and jail type administrators through my life, and they never seem to have problems filling the trustee roles, particularly the attractive ones. Now they have some.
Right.
If you run like Joe Arpaio and you put him in the dog pound, you may, and I don't even know if he has trouble filling that. I just pulled that out of my hat. But there's probably kitchen duty would be one of the harder ones to fill because it's hot and it's early in the morning and you have terrible
it
hours.
Sucks.
Laundry might be.
You're not hungry though. You're not hungry working those gigs.
But my hunch is that there would not be any problem filling these. I don't think there would be any perverse incentive to hang on to people.
And since I said we were going to move on, I can't go without Jen has now also said, isn't that like Kamala Harris and the firefighters, where the firefighters were fighting the California wildfires like a year ago, but then they weren't eligible for these jobs upon release. So these guys and gals might be doing these telemarketing jobs, and then they don't hire convicted felons, but they were perfectly happy to hire them while they were actually locked up.
Well, I don't know that that's the case in that particular job.
Correct.
I would like to get more information. I know that telemarketing is a job that from all that I've been told is more to do with your people skills and your dependability.
Yes.
They don't care so much what you look like. They care what you sound like.
I was going to say, you know, you always talk about having bolts and screws in your face and tattoos. These jobs, you can have all that stuff all over you.
Well, that's exactly that's the reason why when I was in broadcasting that was radio because they told me that my face worked best for radio.
I would agree that you have a face for radio.
It could either break you or make you, and if it breaks you, you know what, you're just going to just be broken physically and mentally.
And then over at thehill.com, Michael Avenatti should not be in solitary confinement. Isn't he the attorney for, Stormy Daniels? And I don't remember her actual name.
He's one of these high-powered lawyers. I think he was connected to the Trump administration, wasn't he? Or not? Have I got him confused?
I thought Michael Avenatti was the one that was representing Stormy Daniels.
Okay, maybe
I could have that way wrong.
So, okay.
Yes, well. Jen says that too. So Michael Avenatti is, like, I've heard many, many things about him. I don't know much more beyond that, but this is, as far as I know, then he's apparently gotten in trouble for maybe making some false things. And anywho, so why are you so against solitary confinement?
Well, the evidence shows us on solitary confinement what it does to the individual. And with Avenatti, he's pre-trial. That makes it even more egregious. I'm not a big fan of solitary confinement. I believe that we ought to be able to manage our prisons in a way that we can keep most of our population safe without having to put them in isolation. Of course, there will be exceptions. There will be people who have a need for isolation for medical reasons. For contagious, we have to do that because we can't have an epidemic through the prison. We have to do that. And we would have people who have committed a disciplinary infraction. And it might be that either they need long-term segregation or short-term segregation to modify their behavior. And when we do that in those conditions where it's really warranted, I have less objection. But what we have is most prisons are overcrowded. And when you design an institution, you design an institution for a lifespan of decades. You don't design when you look at the correctional facilities, they have a very long lifespan. Okay, you get what I'm saying. You don't design a prison for it to be here today and gone tomorrow.
Yes.
When you design it, societal's needs and the type of inmate housing is constantly evolving. So the population and what you designed it for may evolve. It's hard to design a facility with the exact number of types of cells and housing units that you would need over the course of decades. So you have to adapt your prison management to the facility that you're stuck with, because most of the administrators didn't design the facilities. It's the rarest exception where the people who administer it actually designed it. So you have to design, you have to administer with the design you're given. So therefore, if you have a prison that was designed with 100 isolation cells and you're desperate for space, the temptation is to put people in those isolation cells for the most trivial reasons, because you've got a population of a design capacity of 900, and you've got 100 isolation cells at the time they designed it, they thought that was the right number, and you've got excess people, and you need to put them somewhere. So it's easy to plop a person in an isolation cell, and therein lies the problem. So we end up putting people in isolation for not just the things I indicated that are well justified, but just because we don't have any other place to put them. And we put them in there and we forget that we have them in for a different reason. If we put you in there because we can't keep you safe, you're such a hot commodity that you're going to be harmed and exploited and possibly hurt physically, then you shouldn't be punished like the person who threw feces at the guard, who should justifiably lose some privileges during a period of time, because you don't want them throwing feces and exposing themselves to the guards or whatever that got them put in isolation. You're trying to modify that behavior. But when you put a person in because you don't have a facility that's designed and you don't have the staffing to keep that person safe, you don't strip them of all their privileges because of your failure, which is what we do. We put them in, we say, well, you're in isolation, so you don't get any reading material. You don't get visitation when you're in isolation. You don't get to use the phone because you're in isolation. Well, that would be fine if I were in isolation for an infraction, but I'm in isolation because your system failed and you can't keep me safe and you're putting me here for my own safety. So therefore, I should be able to use the phone. I should be able to talk to my attorney. I should be able to read books. I should be able to have my legal materials. I should be able to prepare for trial. Avenatti can't prepare for trial because
you're also missing, like, you've glossed over one. Like, I mean, obviously you're in solitary, but you also can't interact with other humans, which is a critical component of us being a social species.
Well, that goes without saying, but I'll say it. Yes.
Yeah.
It's very hard on the human being when they're put in isolation, and it's now, and in all fairness, there's very few institutions where you're not within earshot of a human being. You may have to yell, but have you been in an institution where no one could hear you? No one at all? No human being could hear you?
No, that's a significant challenge in that world, is trying to find a place where you don't have to hear anybody too.
but it can be a struggle to have a conversation. But I'm more worried about this person who's presumed innocent, who's being punished as if he's been convicted, and who cannot be involved in his defense, can't have access to the reams of documents, and he's not being treated like an innocent person.
They say repeatedly in the article that he's not El Chapo.
Yeah, I like that. He's not.
And for those that you don't know, El Chapo is the biggest drug dealer of our time. He's killed witnesses and competitors, and he escaped. Oh, that's right. He's the one, was it roughly a year ago, that actually escaped from prison. And it's not like he's a, spry young dude that can go, running the 100-yard dash quickly. So he had some help, I suppose.
He didn't escape from a U.S. prison, did he? It was a Mexican prison, wasn't it?
Yes, I believe so. And then they extradited him here, I believe. I'm pretty sure that's true. I didn't follow it that closely. I'm just sort of like, on the fringes of my memory is what I'm remembering. Very good. So Narsal has put Cobb County on notice. And as you described it to me, they are randomly harassing folks, knocking on doors at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, 2 o'clock in the morning, and they're going to visit somewhere between a few times to a very large number of times. So deal with it.
We're going to put Cobb County on notice. We're composing the draft, which is, for those who maybe knew the podcast, we did the same thing. Narsal did the same thing with the Butts County, Georgia, and the Spalding County, Georgia sheriff when they did their Halloween signs in 2018. And we just followed it up in 2019 with the county of Ben Hill, that we put them on notice. This doesn't come as a surprise. So we've learned from reliable sources in Cobb County, which is a north metro county, that the sheriff has invented some requirements. And those requirements that the sheriffs have invented are very troubling, because the policy is articulated to the offenders who are registered in Cobb is that after you present an address, that the department deputies will come to your house at all hours of the day and the night, and as late as at 11:30 at night, and as early as like 5 a.m. in the morning, and pound at your door and demand to see you to verify that you're there. And that is not, it's the Georgia statute doesn't require that, and it's very annoying to have someone pounding on your door at 11 o'clock at night. And in fact, in most jurisdictions, and I think Georgia as well, they don't even allow warrants to be served, a search warrant, unless you have an exception for the hours. They require that search warrants be served during reasonable hours to keep from disturbing the neighborhood and having every dog barking and having that kind of ruckus. And so a search warrant is not going to be served at 3 o'clock in the morning unless you get a no knock special exception. So the sheriff's knocking at 3 o'clock in the morning is dangerous. People's dogs start barking, and people that are sound asleep. What would stop a sex offender? I know sex offenders are convicted felons in most instances, but what would stop someone who lives at the residence who's not a convicted felon from having a weapon and pulling it? And there can be a shootout.
Certainly.
So it's dangerous. So the Cobb County Sheriff is engaging in that, and we like to verify things from more than one source, which we've done, and then they're requiring the offender to provide the hours and schedule of their job. Again, that's not required by the statute. They only have to provide the location and the name of their employer, but not their hours that they're working and what they're doing. So we're going to let the Cobb County Sheriff know. Go ahead.
Oh, this is not a supervision thing. This is the registry side, the civil regulatory scheme side of the equation, where all you have to do is tell them this is the address. They approve the address. that is potentially the end of that interaction. Maybe they actually come out and physically verify it, but after that, that's the end of it.
That is correct, and this is for the registry. This is not for the supervised vendor population. But we've verified they're being required to write down the hours of their work on the registration form and other details. And again, that's not required by statute. And you did put your hand on the Bible, Sheriff Warren, I believe his name is, and you said you were going to uphold the law. You didn't say you were going to invent the law. And as I believe that you have a duty to uphold the law, not to make the law. If you would like to make the law, you should surrender that badge and you should run for the General Assembly in the state of Georgia, and you can have a seat in the legislature and you can be a part of the lawmaking process. But it's not for you to invent your own requirements, just like it wasn't for Sheriff Long to invent his Halloween sign requirement, which we're going to talk about in a little bit. But this here is very troubling. It's where do they stop when they're allowed unchecked to invent their own rules and put requirements on people and threaten them with incarceration, which I don't know what they would incarcerate them for. If you said, look, I'm not going to tell you what hours I work, it's none of your business. If they can't cite anything in the statute that compels the disclosure of that information, then there's nothing legal that can be done. But the average offender doesn't know that. The average offender sees the deputies at the door that have guns on their side and arrest powers, and they see a paddy wagon parked up the street a little bit that they might find themselves sitting in if they don't cooperate. And when the spouse opens the door at 11:30 and I'm here to verify, I need to see whoever right now, the spouse wants to end the encounter as quickly as possible before the kids start screaming, before the neighbors start calling and say, what the hell's going on over here next door?
And I'm going to throw you a softball question, Larry. Why are they doing this?
Well, the simple answer is because they can.
And what would make them stop?
Well, as we found out in Butts County, and Spaulding County stopped because they were served a lawsuit and they decided that it would behoove them to stop. Butts County only stopped when the federal judge said you can't do it, and they have filed their ensuing appeal that we're going to talk about later. But without being challenged, without any pushback, they're going to do it because it sells to the constituents. If Sheriff Neil Warren tells the citizens of Cobb County, let me tell you what I do. Well, I got 915 offenders registered in here in Cobb County. And we go out and visit with them 8, 10, 12 times, and we don't pay no attention to what time we go out. We make sure these people are where they say they are because we're going to keep you safe. Now, do you think the average Cobb County citizen is going to be more likely to vote for them or less likely when they tell them that?
Certainly. Would it be okay for me to break in and tell you a quick little story about a friend of mine in the northeast part of the state that dealt with not this issue, but something along these lines?
Sure.
All right, so I get a call and he says that he is trying to get a new job, and his conviction, the way Georgia works is your conviction, depending on when it was, then you have varying degrees of your restrictions, you know, residency, work restrictions, and what would be included. His actually happened at a time when there weren't any. So he goes and says, hey, I'm getting a job at this particular place. And they said, well, you can't work there because it's 1,000 feet from, park, school, daycare, whatever it was. And he says, but that's not part of the statute. And he goes, doesn't matter. I'm telling you, you can't work there. So he has to take them to court, which I think is, forgive me, bullshit, because he's not obligated to follow those rules. But because they said you can't work there, and, I know you said he should have just said, F you, take the job, and then deal with it afterwards. But he went out and spent $2,500, got an attorney, and the judge is like, you guys have misread the law. And so now he's going to go get this job. My point behind all of this is, to go along with what you've just described, is we have to go step up and throw tomatoes at them and say, you guys have to stop doing this, because otherwise so many of us that are already beat down are going to let them do what they want to do.
That is correct. Now, I don't know that I intended to recommend that he could have done that. That was an option.
No, I don't mean it that way. Yeah.
That is an option he had on the table to consider. If you've done your research, and particularly if you've had a competent attorney validate your research, and you know in Georgia you are correct that that the occurrence of your crime, not when you got sentenced, but when your crime occurred, the actual event that triggers a duty to register, there are progressive restrictions that are added based on what year. So if you were convicted prior to 2003, if your crime occurred, excuse me, prior to 2003, I don't think Correct. You have any. And then as you go through those years succeeding, you have more and more restrictions where you might not be able to live with close to a school, that it might expand to include additional things other than school, daycare, and YMCA, and places where children congregate. And it's a more expansive list, the more recent your event incident occurred. But he could have said, I know I'm right, and what I'm going to do is tell you people that if you cause me any problems, I'm putting you on notice, and he should have done it in writing. I'm putting you on notice that that these provisions, these restrictions, do not apply to me. I've accepted the job, and I will be getting work tomorrow morning. And if you do anything to hinder my ability to work, Cobb County is on notice, or whatever county that was, is on notice that there may be ramifications of a financial nature. And again, I don't know if Georgia requires you to prove your actual damages, but say, for example, he was arrested and he lost the job because they paraded in there to take him away, to teach him a lesson for being defiant. And they put him in shackles and paraded him in front of cameras, and he lost the job, and it was a good job. He might have been able to set him up for some significant civil recovery.
Totally.
So he could he could have considered that as an option as well, but there's nothing wrong with what he did.
I agree. Yeah, and the path of least resistance might have been the path that he took, just to try and rock the boat as little as possible, to move forward, to get the new job, get the pay raise, whatever's all going on with that. And I might have details of the story wrong. I was expecting from you.
How many jobs? How many jobs will wait for you to litigate?
Correct.
Okay. Can you imagine? Well, let me tell you, I don't think these restrictions apply to me. I'm quite certain they don't. But I'll get back to you after I go to court. Now, it's going to take me probably 3-4 months.
Correct.
But will you hold the job for me? Because I know I'm the right candidate. How well would that work out in most? The way to get the job where it would work out, the way to would be, say, it's like the church. When people say they can't go to church, I said, well, you wouldn't ever stop me if I wanted to go to church or go to church. I'd call them up and say, I'm sitting down here to the First Baptist Church, and I'll be in the middle row. And I dare you to come arrest me, which is exactly what they would do. They would come and arrest you if you dared them to do that. And then you would set up a constitutional challenge based on the fact that they would oblige you and come arrest you. It would be very unlikely that they wouldn't come arrest you. But we would find an answer to whether the government can intrude in a religious establishment and tell them that they can't have someone in their pews that they're okay with. And I'd make sure that the church was okay with me being in that pew before I sat there, because I wouldn't want the church to be on the opposite side of the argument from me. But if I could get the church on my side, I would do exactly that and say, it's none of your business who's in this sanctuary. And in fact, the Constitution prevents you from having any say-so about what goes on in the sanctuary. Well, I shouldn't say it. You can't break the law in the sanctuary. But in terms of who is in the sanctuary, that's the church's business.
I do say, Larry, that you must have some really big cojones. And I've been sitting here for like 3 or 4 minutes trying to think of the most politically correct way I can say this without sounding sexist or crude or anything like that. But I can't think of any other way to word this.
You can't say that.
You are brave. You are a brave, brave individual.
You need to strike that from the record.
Because it's a family-oriented program?
It is, and somebody might translate that and know what it means.
Yes, I'm sure the transcription and the transcriptionist will get... Anything else about the Cobb County thing that you want to go over?
I'm hoping that they will actually consider the letter. Based on our experience with the other counties, they're not likely to do anything other than continue what they're doing, which means that we'll probably have to file another lawsuit.
Let me just one other point. So there's an organization that I tangentially follow, and I hear about that organization having their staff attorneys, and they file challenges against constitutional things all the time, and very often just by having a sternly worded letter from an attorney saying, these are the reasons why you are violating these statutes, laws, constitutional principles, etc. And almost always, the institution backs down.
Well, I don't have enough experience to know if it's almost always, but in instances they do. I know in some instances they don't. I know the city of Berlin has told the Freedom from Religious Foundation, the city of Berlin is located in New Mexico, they told them they can pound sand about their nativity scene that they put, and they tell them they got something to file it. and they can't find a single person in Berlin to give them the standing. So the Freedom from Religion Foundation has not been persuasive at all. But a sternly worded letter that is backed up by previous action, and the previous action has been successful, it very much can be effective. Absolutely can be effective. And that's what our hope is. We're hoping that we will convey to them that we are the culprits on the Spalding County and Butts County case. You might want to take us seriously because we told them in advance that we were coming for them, and now we're focused on you.
Yeah.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
Well, then so I have the main segment here, and we're going to talk about the Butts County appeal, and then I have the double main segment. So this is the single main segment about Butts County appeal. This rolls back to where in Georgia, I guess it was last Halloween that we learned of them posting signs. So then over the previous year, through 2019, a lawsuit was developed. An attorney was brought on board. What's the word I'm looking for? The individuals in Butts County with standing, they were brought in, and it went to federal court. I guess it would have been like the second or third week of October, just like a week before Halloween, even just days before Halloween. And the judge ruled in our favor, saying that they couldn't post these signs. The signs didn't say sex offender, but we had a Facebook post from the sheriff where he was like, "Hey, I'm letting you people know that these sex offenders, these are going to have the signs in their yard." And so we won. And so now they filed, what did you say, 100-something page appeal?
Only 71.
Oh, sorry, 71. Is this like double spaced with 7-inch margins or something, or is this like dense copy?
No, it's double spaced with inch margins, so it's not as bad as it seems. But it's a lot of briefing. The number of words is always in the certification at the end. How many words is in the brief? And it's a lengthy brief.
So they are doubling down that a federal judge said that they couldn't put these signs out. And they're doubling down, and didn't Long say he would carry it all the way to the Supreme Court if he had to?
That's what Sheriff Long in Butts County said. He said, "I'm going to take this to the Supreme Court if I have to."
Did he say it just like that?
Pretty much like that. He said court.
Court. I kind of struggle with the idea. So it seemed that the judge, because I was sitting there in court, it seemed like the judge was hyper-rational to me. And he seemed to be asking to me some really excellent questions to both sides about, you know, to sharpen the various points that they didn't have the justification, the jurisdiction to post these signs, that their intent was to humiliate, to call out, not just for the interest of public safety, because they could have accomplished the thing in different ways other than posting these signs in the people's yards. And they went back to the positioning of the signs and what authority do they have to post the signs there. But they're doubling down on those points to then have their appeal.
That is correct. And just to bring the any new listeners up to speed and some of the older ones who may still be confused, what we won was an injunction. The case has still not been tried on the merits.
An injunction just means they're like, stop, don't do that. We're not saying you're right or wrong, but don't do that for now.
Well, an injunction is a slight bit stronger than that. The standard is that you have to prove to get an injunction that you're going to likely prevail on the merits and that irreparable harm will ensue without the injunction. And there's two other components that are less significant, but the two primary components are likelihood of success on the merits and the irreparable harm. And so you're having a relief given to you that you haven't won yet. So you're getting a preliminary order that says, before this case goes to trial, I'm going to give you this relief. So the relief that was given was the sheriff was told he cannot put the signs up for the plaintiffs in the lawsuit. And he interpreted it, as far as we can tell, they didn't put them up anywhere. But it was really specific to the plaintiffs in the lawsuit. And that's what's under appeal. And so the case is still hasn't gone to trial. The parties had actually agreed that they would stay any further proceedings toward trial until this granting of the injunction was appealed. Normally, you have the mootness doctrine that would kick in, but the mootness, this is an exception to the mootness doctrine. And these lawyers that are representing the county of Butts, if you look in the page numbers are going to be wonky depending on how you look at page numbers, because at the top of the pleading, the court gives everything a page number based on just simply when the computer scans it. If it's the first page, it's page one. But then since there's table of authorities and there's table of contents, all the stuff that don't count. But if you start at page one of where they're numbered numerically, which is actually page 13, by the way the court numbered it, they explain about the exception to mootness, and it says the enjoined conduct relates to Halloween holiday, and the 2019 celebration of the holiday has passed. Nevertheless, this case falls within a special category of disputes that are capable of repetition while evading review, and that's one of the exceptions to the mootness doctrine. The first condition is met, and this goes on to the next page, because Halloween 2019 occurred before appellate review could be had, and we agree with that, and Halloween 2020 is approximately 10 months away. These time frames are too short for full litigation to produce a final judgment by the trial court and decision. So therefore, and the second condition is plainly met because Halloween is certain to recur every year. So unless we declare Halloween not to be recognized any longer, Halloween will occur again. So this is one of those disputes that falls within the exceptions. It's not moot because it's going to repeat. The same dispute's going to be alive and well. So we get to the point of, so they're saying, we want you to decide this at an appellate level and lift the injunction so we can do our thing. And then they go pages and pages and pages of just specious and total crappy arguments. I mean, I give them credit. They have put a lot of work into putting together arguments that really are, I mean, you're stretching. But if you look at the statement of issues, they've thrown everything at the statement of issues. They have nine contentions of where the trial judge got wrong. That's bad when you have that many issues. It's kind of like we talked about the case in Texas where Estes Hightower threw everything up at the kitchen sink hoping something would stick.
Okay,
that's kind of what they've done on their appeal here. They've challenged the court on everything. So they've made nine contentions. And I'm not even going to try to focus on all nine. I'm going to try to focus on just a couple, three of them in our analysis here, because they're really big on what compelled speech is, and they're arguing that this compelled speech is not that the offender is not being required to speak, that this is government speak, so therefore it's not compelled speech. And then they're claiming this is the most specious argument of all. They're saying that they, as the defendants, that their First Amendment right is being trampled on, which is totally specious and bogus. The sheriff does have some First Amendment rights, but not in this context, the way he's trying to frame it. So I'm going to focus on that, and then the standard of review, which they're saying it should be just a low level of rational basis, where the district judge found strict scrutiny was the proper level. I happen to believe that strict scrutiny may not be the proper level. I think intermediate scrutiny may be the proper level, but we won't get a lot into that either, because most people that don't have legal training are going to be, their head's going to be spinning. But the sheriff is arguing that these signs are being placed on public property. The sheriff is claiming that the signs for 50 or 60 feet, depending on which parcel they analyzed each plaintiff deed, and they say that either 50 or 60 feet belongs to the government, and that the government can put whatever they want to on that 50 or 60 feet.
Wouldn't the government owe me money for maintaining that particular part of the land if they owned it?
Well, that's what's so troubling for me. The right of way, and I profess no expertise in property law and right of way, and my knowledge is very basic. But my understanding of right of way was that it was still the property owner's property, but certain usages were authorized by the right of way, whatever that period, whatever that number of feet would be. That's allowed for specific use. They may need to run a line to service somebody, and they have right of way to run that line, whether it be a telephone line or whether it be a water line or whatever. They have the right to run a utility line through that area. They would have the right, theoretically, I suppose, to put speed control and traffic control devices on the right of way. But the sheriff has taken the position that not only does he have the right to put utility, use it for utility access, that he can put his signs to carry his message, and that you as the owner of that property have no say-so about what goes on the property. And it looks like from the admissions and stipulations that they use the mailbox for people who have mailboxes, the stopping point. And of course, in older neighborhoods, some people have mailboxes right by their front door. You know, they put back in the old days, they put them on people's homes. So if you look at a neighborhood that was built probably before the 1970s, you'll see those black mailboxes hanging outside their front door. So I don't know what he would do if you had your mailbox by the door.
Right. What is sort of like a timeline for, so this has just been filed? How long does this then take to go through, and, you know, what's the next step?
Well, the next step would be that the party that took the appeal files the opening brief. So the winning party, which would be on the injunction, this is the only issue under appeal, is the injunction. The case has not been tried yet. So the prevailing party will file a response brief. I'll get it right in a second here. They'll file a response, and they're given X number of days. And since I'm not regular in federal court, I believe it's 30 days, but they'll be given a period between 20 and 30 days to file a response brief. And then the party that filed the opening brief can file a reply in response to that brief. So then at the end of that process, then the court will decide what it needs to do next. Now, they've asked for oral argument, and I expect our side's going to want oral argument as well. But they, in all likelihood, with something this complicated, oral argument will be granted. The court will deem that it's helpful. So in terms of the timeline, I'm predicting at least a year, maybe a couple of years before this thing plays itself out in court.
Really?
I'm always hoping it's faster, but there's a lot of briefing that has to be done before. Like I say, we've got a brief to file. Then they have a reply to file. The court has to decide if it needs to develop anything else. If the briefs are not sufficient, they might order some special briefing in addition to what's already been done. And then the oral argument schedule, they don't just schedule those and set them up for next week. I mean, there's a time lag for that, so they're going to have to schedule oral arguments, get the people to Atlanta to hold the arguments, and then after that, they may order, depending on what happens in oral argument, they may order additional briefing. If something complicated comes out in oral argument that's confusing, they may, and then the case will await a decision, and there's no timeline on when they can issue the decision. They can take as long as they want.
Where I was going with that, so the injunction stays in place until this next leg of the court process goes through.
The injunction will remain until it's dissolved. And until the court that issued the injunction dissolves it, or until the appellate court says you got it wrong, the injunction's in place.
So if this took 2 years, as you just described, then 2020 Halloween may already just be safe, that we don't have to worry about it, at least in that county. Yeah?
Not necessarily. The injunction only applied to the named plaintiffs. So if I'm Sheriff Long, and I'm trying to make points with my constituents, I'm going to say, well, I tell you what I'm going to do. I've got a bunch of liberals up there trying to keep me from doing my job and keeping y'all safe down here. But I wish I could protect all of you, but the ones that sued me, I can't do nothing about them, but I'm going to put the signs up on everybody else's house, and I would keep doing what I was doing because there was nothing in that order that precluded him from doing that. Now, the judge expressed, and the district judge expressed consternation that even though it was limited, that the same legal analysis would apply to everybody. But what if I were the sheriff? Now, sheriff, I know you're listening to our podcast. So strategy,
clearly.
The strategy for you to do, because you're going to end up losing this at the end, but to maximize your political gain, which is what you're after, what you would do is wait until the last possible moment and then announce you're going to do this in 2020 and don't give us chance to gear up and come to get an injunction against a blanket injunction stopping you from doing it to everybody. But now, since I've already thought about that, I'm going to be encouraging our legal team to see if we can go ahead and seek an injunction to stop you from doing it to anybody. But technically, right now, he's only restrained from doing it to the named plaintiffs.
About to ask you, whose team are you on, man?
Well, I'm on the team of the offenders. But if I can think of it, I have never assumed myself to be more brilliant than the people that they hire and pay big bucks. If I can think of this sitting here, I'm quite certain that they can think of this.
I was actually just like trying to channel that quote that you've given me about the, I'm just trying to win the game. Why did you make that play, coach?
Well, that's very simple. We're trying to win the game. We're going to have to put that one on too.
I know. So I was like, why would you think of these things, Larry?
Because I'm trying to win the game.
Gotcha.
And if I can imagine that Sheriff Long would do it, I'm very comfortable and confident saying that I believe that Sheriff Long, his mind is at least as creative as mine. If it weren't, we wouldn't be in this position with these high-dollar lawyers that are spending a lot of Butts County money to fight what I view as going to be a frivolous appeal. It's frivolous for so many reasons. He's even put forth a theory that is totally bogus about free speech. As a defendant, he says that he has the right to free speech, and he does. He absolutely has a right to speak freely. But he doesn't have the right to commandeer another person's platform. And to illustrate the point, show up at a church and tell them that you have a counter message you'd like to deliver, and you demand equal time from the pulpit to deliver that message and see what they tell you. Show up at Rush Limbaugh's studios in sunny South Florida and tell him that you have a counter message to what he's doing, and that you would like to have equal time to deliver that message and see what they tell you. You do not have the right to a platform that you do not own. What you have a right to in the First Amendment is for the government not to interfere by either restraining your speech or compelling you to speak. And the sheriff is not being restrained from speaking. He can speak all he wants to about vile sex offenders if that's what he wants to say. He can say that. He's only being limited in using private property, and he's arguing that it's government property, but he's only being limited in conveying a message on property that he doesn't own. Thus, it's not his pulpit, but he has the right to say anything he wants to say about sex offenders. That's for the voters.
Well, yeah, the judge told, like, couldn't you put, you know, if you had the staff, couldn't you put an officer in front of everybody's house to achieve the same thing?
Well, like,
I could.
That's addressed in the brief. He said he's got 57 offenders in Butts County, that it would cost him $10,000, and that it would divert all of his manpower from legitimate law enforcement functions. That's what he said in the brief. But this,
which is literally a funny thing to say also, because there's literally no threat. There hasn't been any reported problem on Halloween by any of our people to begin with that he has invented a threat.
Well, he addressed that in the brief. He says that's because his policies are working.
So his policies are working nationwide then?
Well, I guess he would not worry about that, but he says his policies are working. But back to this speech thing, because he's hung a lot of his argument on his speech rights. He doesn't have, he went out to the Ninth Circuit, which is the liberal do-gooders based in California, and he cited a case out of the Ninth Circuit, the liberal runaway Ninth Circuit, that has no relevance in this dispute. And this is why this is complicated work, because if you look at this brief of the table of authorities, there's page after page after page of table of authorities where they use federal, U.S. Supreme Court, federal district court, federal appellate cases, state Supreme Court cases. They've got all these cases, and they all need to be read. I have only read one of them. I read the case he cited from the Ninth Circuit of Mulligan who the hell was the other? It was it's in the show notes. But he cited
Nichols,
yeah. But he cited a case where there was the it doesn't support his position at all. When you're a government employee, where the courts have protected speakers is when the government retaliates if you say our meat inspection service is not good. They've sped the lines up too much, and it's compromising food safety inspections, and then the person gets fired. They have the right to speak that, and they've been upheld on that. That they have the right to speak. And you don't lose your rights to speak just because you work for the government. The government can't suppress all of your private speech. But Sheriff Long, you are the government in this case.
Yeah.
You are the government. You're the one who's trying to force the offender to carry your message, although he takes great pains with pages and pages of arguments that this isn't a message. This is a neutral message. It's not about a sex offender. We don't even say they're sex offenders in the sign. We just say no trick or treating here. Public service announcements from Butts County Sheriff. And he says therefore there's no endorsement by the sex offender. He's saying that compelled speech is only problematic if a reasonable person believes that the person is endorsing the message. And he says it's clear that the sex offender doesn't endorse the message. So therefore, it doesn't qualify as compelled speech. And that's a bogus argument. If he put a sign up, which the sheriff has the right to endorse candidates. What if he put a sign up in front of your house that said he endorsed a candidate? Say, what was that guy's name that ran for governor of Louisiana that was the Klan? David Duke. David Duke, and I'm trying to think of a Georgia equivalent that we could localize it. Someone, J.B. Stoner would be the Georgia equivalent. Google J.B. Stoner while I'm talking about this. But if Stoner were still alive, and he's not, but if Sheriff Long said, well, I got the right to my free speech too, so I'm going to put a sign up endorsing J.B. Stoner. It's on the government right away, so therefore, that would be, everybody would logically conclude that you were for J.B. Stoner. So would Sheriff Long be entitled to put a sign up endorsing J.B. Stoner because he has free speech right? Of course not.
I understand. And that is why you are here.
Oh, really? Well, there's 71 pages here. There are a lot of highlights throughout the document for folks to enjoy who love to read. Hank, I know you'll love to go through it, and there are others out there similar to Hank. We would have to spend far more time than we have on this, but the arguments that the sheriff has put forward, I think, will largely fail. Hopefully they'll largely fail. I believe they'll fail, but we still have to go through all this. And it's going to require a lot of work on the legal team. If they ask me for help, I will be glad to provide what help I can. But they've got a mammoth brief to respond to, and whether it's 20 or 30 days, it's a short duration of time because they also have another practice of law. They both have other clients. This is not their only case. So
I see. And it's the same attorney that was representing our side to follow through to the next step?
That is correct. That would be the same team. It would be on this appeal.
Very good. Anything else, or are we moving on?
We're moving on. We're having fun tonight.
Should we be like the Jeffersons and we're moving on up?
I think so.
Finally, we are going to, this is the double main segment. So this is like double strawberry ice cream or something like that. Double main segment. Federal judge in Illinois parole case issues permanent injunction. And I know nothing about this case. So it's all you, man.
Well, we've talked about this case. This is the case of Murphy versus Roll. And Adele Nicholas and Mark Weinberg out of Illinois won this case at the district court level. in March 31st, 2019. There's a short permanent injunction order, which will be attached to the show notes with some highlights that what's going on in Illinois and in New Mexico and possibly other states that we're not aware of, but clearly those two states, is you serve your prison sentence. And those of you who have federal convictions can relate to this. In the federal system, you have a finite sentence imposed on you, and you serve it less the 15% or the 54 days or the 48 days. And I think there was some dispute about whether it was 52 days, 54 days, or 48 days. But you serve that time, and then you go into a period of supervised release that can be relatively short to lifetime supervised release. But that supervised release period is outside the walls. So when you serve your time in the federal system, you will be released. When that 85% has been served, then that floodgate will open and you will go out. And usually you go out a little bit earlier because they start your transition to a halfway house release process before. But on that 85%, when you've served your time, you leave. Well, in Illinois, they have a very similar system. They call it MSR, mandatory supervised release. And when you serve your time less your good time credits and you've maxed out your sentence, then you go into this period of post-prison supervision and you're under the prisoner review board and to serve the MSR. Well, the prisoner review board imposes conditions on you that you can't meet because you can't live within distances that make so many things off limit. So as a consequence, the person sits in prison. And those who have more financial resources have been able to have more options available to them. So this has turned out to be something that contains people that have no resources at a higher rate, but it contains a whole lot of people. And so the judge found it unconstitutional that they can't do that. And that's what inspired us to do similar litigation in New Mexico. We're going to litigate against our parole board, or they call it the prisoner review board. And we call it a period of parole, where they call it a period of mandatory supervised release. We have it artificially call it parole, but it's not parole in the literal sense, because in Arkansas, after you serve 1/6 or 1/5 or some arbitrary amount of your time, you're eligible to be released on parole if you can meet the conditions of good behavior and an acceptable home plan. And people in Arkansas are writing to us saying, well, you people don't understand, in New Mexico, we're sitting in prison too in Arkansas because they won't release us. Well, but see, the difference is you haven't served all your time. Theoretically, when you serve all your time in Arkansas, you will be released. In New Mexico and Illinois, you serve all your time and you will not be released. Well, this judge has said since March, since his opinion finding that the people's constitutional rights were being violated, the 8th and 14th Amendments were being violated, that the state of Illinois has not been able to come up with a solution. So therefore, he's given them timelines on what to do and what's going to happen. So basically, he's going to open the floodgates, which is what I said is all a judge can do. The judge can't force the state to appropriate money to create alternative housing. Judge can't do that. All the judge can do is say, well, I tell you what I am going to do is that if you don't do that, which I can't compel you to do that, what you will do is you will release these people from custody on this date. So the judge has telegraphed to them that they have until January 2nd, 2021, which is roughly a year, to do what they need to do to get these people out of prison. And at that point, the court will consider releasing them, and I believe the court will release them. And the exception that they've telegraphed that they're going to make is for the people who prefer not to be, because you are under mandatory supervised release conditions. And if you prefer to stay in prison, if you're one of those rare persons who says, well, I'm not going to comply with all your crap, I'm not going to do polygraph, I'm not going to do this, I'm not going to do that, and you can take your MSR and shove it, then you can't. They do have an alternate program for you. And the judge is recognizing that if you fit in the category of you prefer to stay in prison rather than comply with MSR, you can do that. But otherwise, the floodgates are going to open in about a year.
And how many people would be affected by that?
Well, according to this document, there's about 290, I believe it said. It says, but despite the party's good faith effort, more than 290 class members remain in prison beyond their completion of their prison terms due to inability to satisfy the host site requirement. The classes continue to grow larger as additional individuals complete their prison sentences and become eligible for mandatory supervised release and are unable to secure an approved host site. So it's going to get worse.
Right.
And I think we probably have well over 100 here. It's certainly approaching 100. I'd be very surprised if we don't have 100 that are in prison simply because they want to prove their where they want to live. But they've done their time.
Yeah, so they're being held past their time of their original sentence.
That is correct.
And as far as I know, can we scale the degree of constitutional violation? Like this seems like this would be false imprisonment. This would be a pretty high thing of violating the Constitution.
I would think so, in my opinion. And in fact, I would be delighted to see that legal team in Illinois seek economic damages on behalf of these people, because they've been harmed. Their productive potential has been stifled. Some of these people have been sitting in prison for years. Not days or weeks, but years. As I read that complaint and the judge's order back last year in March, those people have been sitting in prison for years.
That would really suck that you know, like, hey, I'm getting out of prison tomorrow. Oh, nope, not today, not tomorrow, not next week. You're just in permanent limbo. You're like in a Groundhog Day for some sort of indefinite period of time.
So, and this is tragic. It's happening here, and we're hoping to ride the coattails. That case is not binding, but the analysis that was done by the court there in Illinois, the Northern District, is so good that we feel like that we will be able to benefit from the work that court's done and laying the foundation for our lawsuit.
Fill me in on something, and hopefully I can reclaim this thought. Oh, we covered, I want to say it was like the first episode of the new year, of building a body of case law to support these things. I assume this goes into the mix of building a body of case law to support all of these, like, you know, obviously these attorneys aren't representing people in Oregon or Washington or other places where people are being held past their time. But someone could use their arguments and expand on them and tailor them to their specifics to help pave the way that their road has been plowed, so to speak.
That is correct. As long as you understand the difference between persuasive and binding authority, this district court in Northern Illinois is not binding anywhere outside of Northern Illinois. And if it goes up on appeal, which it hasn't, but if it went up on appeal, then it would only be the appellate would only be binding in that jurisdiction. But we can cite to a district court level decision as persuasive authority. And that's what, so the body of case law, every time there's a well written opinion that is cited as persuasive authority, but you disclose to the court, you say this case is from the Northern District of Illinois. It parallels our circumstances here in New Mexico, although we don't call it MSR, we call it parole. You've actually served all your time before, and then we use the same parallel. There's only one halfway house that'll accept sex offenders. They have a 3-year waiting list, and it costs thousands of dollars to get in, which means that people without resources are not even able to get on the waiting list. And we draw the analogy to essentially what they did in Illinois, that was a debtor's prison for the people who don't have money, because the people who have money can put forth to the prison review board other options that a person without any funding can put forward. So we would cite to that and say, of course, you're not bound by this, but it certainly is persuasive. And that's what I mean by the body of case law.
Yeah. That covers it, I guess. I can't think of any other questions. I mean, you know, these people are being held in prison past their time just because there isn't some place that they can be housed. It's not much more complicated than that.
Well, and theoretically, this is where conservatives and liberals would come together. It doesn't seem to happen. But the conservatives, who are the guardians, how old are they? The guardians of the financial purse.
That with such contempt, Larry.
Well, because it's such hypocrisy that they are the guardians. They're actually the ones who go on spending sprees every chance they can. But they claim to be such guardians of the purse. They would not want this money to be spent, because they would recognize, being fiscal stewards and such wise managers, that keeping people incarcerated is more costly than community options. Well, the liberal do-gooders should also say, gee, we're all about rehabilitation and reintegration and family reunification, all these feel-good things. So you should be able to get some sort of consensus. But that all falls apart when it comes to sex offenders. For some reason, they all agree that we won't touch that class of people, and all that stuff just doesn't come. In fact, they're carved out for exceptions for everything that's supposed to be moving criminal justice reform forward, there's always a carve-out, which causes great consternation for our affiliate up in Connecticut.
I do understand.
Yeah, she's on the warpath. She's on the warpath about carve-outs. And
you must be talking about Cindy. Should we say her name?
I don't know if we need to, but yes, our Connecticut affiliate is on the warpath about carve-outs, and I agree with her.
I like Cindy. She cracks me up.
You're in a political dilemma. You've got legislation that can't make it to the finish line without the carve-outs, so you end up helping no one if you stand on your principal belief that I could get relief for some people or no people, which is better.
I do understand that. I personally think that we should try. Of course, we're trying to save everybody, but if we could save one, wouldn't that be better than saving none?
Well, I you should use the Titanic. You know, I tell people, well, according to your doctrine, there, for some reason, there weren't enough lifeboats. I think because they believed that the vessel was not sinkable, but there weren't enough boats, and then they didn't deploy them correctly at the time. But it would make no sense to say, well, yeah, we got enough boats to save about half of us. I guess we'll all go down together. Now, the difficulty was figuring out which half. But it makes no sense for everyone to die because you can't save everyone. To me, that would make no sense for everybody. Well, the same thing. If prisons are as bad as we say they are, and I do believe they are absolutely as bad as we say they are, and I do believe that people should be out of prisons, if I can't get everyone out of prison that I believe should be out, wouldn't I want to be able to get as many out as I can?
I completely agree. Completely, completely agree.
So, well, put that in your pipe for this week.
And then I will smoke it. Larry, we record this show live usually Saturday nights around 7 p.m. Eastern. You can join the Discord server and listen live. But if you can't listen live, you can always do it on demand, which is the whole point anyway, to listen on demand. We want to make this available to you at your convenience. If you would do me a favor and subscribe. This is doing yourself a favor to subscribe in your favorite podcast app. Google, Apple, Stitcher, Slacker, Pocket Cast, Overcast, whatever. Even we have a YouTube channel. By subscribing, you do two things. One, you make sure that you'll get the episode the minute we post it. It'll come right down to you on your device, so you can have it in plenty of time for your Tuesday drive to work. But you can also, you'll send a signal to those apps that certain people like this program, and then it'll help other people find it. And we need some questions, Larry. How could they dial in and ask you a question?
It's 747-227-4477. And I think I know what's happened. I think that since we've done 111 previous episodes, we've answered every question that people have been thinking about.
That is quite possible. It is also possible that we answer anything in anticipation of any question they could have that they can't even ask a question. Larry has already answered this question for me. So there's nothing for them to even say.
But as we pick up new listeners, as we do, there'll be new questions from people. If you started episode 111, you haven't heard. Some people go back and listen to previous episodes, but some people just start from today.
That is very true. And then ultimately, since it's tax season coming up, what is the best way to support the program, Larry?
That would be to become a subscriber. And we have to meet that 100 goal by 2020, by Christmas 2020, because 100 is such a magic number of supporters. And even if it's the dollar level, it'll explain the rubric, but if the more people support it, the more popular we are, and the more search people, these search engines pick us up, and all these good things happen if we have more supporters. Absolutely.
Patreon. And where do they go to do that support?
Patreon.com/registrymatters. And it's tax season. And didn't we talk about what they could do since they could have a refund coming? Yeah,
they could sign their return over to us. That would be amazing kinds of support.
Do we have a special account number that they can deposit that a check into?
No, I don't think. I mean, I suppose if someone wanted to reach out, I could give them my personal PayPal account. But, you know, short of that, just send a check. You can send a check.
And on a serious note, there's no expectation that you do that. But any level of support would be appreciated. And we do appreciate the supporters we have. You're all so awesome.
And follow us on Twitter, follow us on YouTube, and that's all I got, Larry. And anything else you got?
Well, if you want to send Andy a naughty message, send it to registrymatterscast@gmail.com.
Yes.
Registrymatterscast@gmail.com.
Well, that is all I got. And I hope you have a great night, Larry, and I'll talk to you soon.
Good night.